Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to the Renaissance English History Podcast, a part of the Agora Podcast Network. I'm your host, Heather Tesco, and I'm a storyteller who makes history accessible because I believe it's a pathway to understanding who we are, our place in the universe, and to more deeply connecting with our own humanity. This is episode 132, and it's an interview with Tony Riches about Catherine Willoughby, the subject of his new book. But before we get into that, I just want to remind you that even if you can't come to TudorCon in person, there are digital streaming watch party tickets available. So all of the talks will be filmed and you'll be able to download them and watch them later with the transcripts. We'll be live streaming the whole weekend. And so you'll be able to be a part of the fun and excitement even if you aren't there in person. So go to englandcast.com/TudorCon2019 to learn more about that. And we will see you online, even if we can't see you in person. So with that all out of the way, let me introduce you to Tony Riches. Tony Riches was born in Pembrokeshire in West Wales, UK, and he spent part of his childhood in Kenya. He got a BA degree in psychology and an MBA from Cardiff University. He wrote several successful nonfiction books, and then he decided that his real interest was in the history of the 15th and 16th century, and now his focus is on writing historical fiction about the lives of the key figures of medieval history. His Tudor trilogy, which starts with the book Owen and traces Owen, Jasper, and then Henry Tudor, it's become an international bestseller, and he is in regular demand as a guest speaker about the lives of the early Tudors. He was a finalist in the 2017 Amazon Storyteller Awards, and is listed 130th in the 2018 top 200 list of the most influential authors. He's now returned to Pembrokeshire, an area full of inspiration for his writing, where he lives with his wife. In his spare time, he enjoys sailing and sea kayaking. About Catherine Willoughby now.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you questions in two sorts of veins, one of which is just her life and, you know, who she was, and then your interpretation of her.
Yeah.
And yeah, what it's like writing her. So, you know, she kind of fulfills, like you talked before about how she was kind of this link in the next part of the story. Can you talk to me a little bit about how she is the carry-on from Charles Brandon and the story that you've been telling really since Owen?
Yes, well, that's exactly right, is that I originally started researching Henry because I was born in Pembroke, the same as Henry Tudor. And then I went back a couple of generations to look at Owen Tudor, who at the time he didn't have a bad press. He didn't have any press at all, really. So that was where I started from. And then each book seamlessly slightly overlapped and continued somebody else's story. So in Owen, Henry was born. And then in Jasper, the second book, he came of age. He became king in the third book. And it was easy to decide where to go next because his daughter, Henry's daughter, Mary Tudor, nursed him through his dreadful time with the quinsy when he could hardly swallow or let alone speak. And I was intrigued by Mary's story because, of course, her brother Henry promptly sent her off at 18 to marry the King of France. And that led to studying Brandon's life, of course. And I realised then that I had the Tudor trilogy, but it'd be perfectly good to have the Brandon trilogy, because it would be Mary with Charles Brandon. And then after Mary's days, of course, he marries his young ward, 14-year-old ward, Catherine Willoughby. And the more I started looking into Catherine's story, I was absolutely fascinated, because it's a proper roller coaster ride, whether you're talking about just relationships or a Tudor woman in the time of the Tudor court, or the religious seesaw that was going on, where you could get burnt at the stake for being on either side at various times. I shouldn't laugh. It wasn't funny to be burnt at the stake, but...
But even Henry himself, and one day he'd burn Anne Askew, and then on the other day he's burning the monks. It's like...
But you see, Catherine actually knew Anne Askew, because Anne was a Lincolnshire woman who got thrown out by her Catholic husband for wanting a simpler form of religion. And Catherine Willoughby was very much tuned into that, and nice. So helped her. But then when Anne was being tortured on the rack in the Tower of London, Catherine must have been really quite concerned that at some point she'd be named. And of course, they used to ask very leading questions, you know. So, is Catherine Willoughby a witch and a heretic? And if Anne Askew just said the word yes, then Catherine could have been burnt at the stake. But the amazing thing is that, I mean, you have to respect Anne Askew. She went to her death without naming Catherine Willoughby. And that really must have hardened Catherine's views about reform and the need for reform and the injustice of it all, you know. It's really quite difficult to understand. Just, it was a matter of life and death, what religion you believed in. And I know there are countries in the world that are still a bit like that today, but it is completely shocking. And so the other interesting dynamic, of course, is that Catherine's mother, Maria de Salinas, was a champion of Catholicism, and Catherine of Aragon's lifelong companion. So Catherine Willoughby was brought up a staunch Catholic, so she had that as a background. Last month, I visited Grimsthorpe Castle, and I'd always thought that the chapel was a fairly modest thing, being a Protestant chapel. But the chapel is a prominent room in the castle. As you go into the Great Hall, you turn right, and there is this magnificent high-ceiling room. And it was just amazing to stand in there and think, this is where Hugh Latimer preached, risked his life, by the way, to preach to Catherine and her neighbours about the need for a simpler form of religion that ordinary people could understand. And he got burnt at the stake for that in Oxford with Cranmer. That was, you know, the greatest injustice. And I think if I had time, I'd write a whole book about Hugh Latimer, because what a character, you know.
And yet it's so hard to get it, you know, that it happened then with the other. I got into Tudor history, gosh, 25 years ago through singing the music of William Byrd, and think, you know, in high school and learning that he was a recusant Catholic, and what's a recusant Catholic, and, you know, getting, that was kind of my entree into this, was the Latin masses that were written during the Elizabethan period that were sung in secret, and that really appealed to the rebellious teenager in me, you know, and there's it on both sides. It just this. I wonder how much of that could be a whole discussion. But how much of that was also linked to kind of the new scientific discoveries and the realization that people were making that that maybe the Earth wasn't the center of the universe and religion wasn't all. You know, we're right before the Enlightenment, and it's almost like there has to be this last gasp of religious fervor taking over on both sides and. Makes me think about that.
It's interesting because before I started researching Catherine, I had this view of Protestant martyrs as rather dour people that were whitewashing over the beautiful paintings of saints and pulling down these magnificent effigies that had been there for centuries. And my view completely changed as I carried on, because all they wanted was for ordinary people to be able to go to church and pray in their own language, not in Latin. Bearing in mind, most of them couldn't read or write. So a simpler form of religion, which was relevant and meaningful to them, is, you could see how they thought that was a cause worth championing. And then, of course, there were all sorts of people. But Stephen Gardiner, Bishop Stephen Gardiner, really set himself against Catherine. And that's a great story in itself, isn't it? How both of them, for completely different reasons, had the attention of Henry VIII. And Catherine had a mischievous streak and would deliberately goad Stephen Gardiner and make him look silly. And of course, it was quite hard for him to defend all the pomp and extravagance, you know, that the Catholic bishops dressed in gold, cloth of gold and velvet and all that sort of thing. And what Catherine was saying is that you're only men, you're only ordinary men, you know?
Yeah.
And he couldn't put up with that at all. So there's the famous story is that she named her spaniel Gardiner and used to call it to heel at court, which, of course, they used to fall about laughing at that. But it was a dangerous game to play, and she knew it. One thing she wasn't was naive, because she really knew what she was doing. And these days, I think she'd be quite an astute politician, using political influence more overtly than a lot of people might expect her to.
So let's go back to the start of her story here, because we already have her now with Catherine Parr at court. So let's go back to when she first met Charles Brandon, and yes. how did that all happen?
She'd led such a sheltered life, because her mother closeted her away at Parham Old Hall. And really, although Catherine, she was named after Catherine of Aragon, and she would have met her and known, she would have been quite comfortable with the royalty aspect of it, because her mother had been involved with royalty all of her life. But when Catherine's father died, not only did she become Baroness d'Eresby, she also became the wealthiest heiress in the country, because she inherited 30 manors from her father, and each manor consisted of lots of farms and tenants and houses and God knows what else. And Charles Brandon, as we know, would have had his eye on her right from the moment her father died. He would have rubbed his hands together, and he went to Henry and borrowed the money to buy her wardship, ostensibly as a bride for his son, also named Henry after the king. And so that all seems fair enough. But he only waited 3 months after Mary died before he married Catherine. And it's that raised the eyebrows at court, not the age difference, because it's so important not to apply modern standards to it all, because, you know, Brandon was my age, and then she was a 14-year-old, not naive, but she'd led a very sheltered life. Can you imagine what a culture shock it was to go from basically being an only child at Parham Hall to being in this hectic household with Brandon's other daughters and everything that was going on at Westhorpe. So she had a lot to get used to and a lot of adjustments to make. And then straight away, she's right into the Tudor court and meeting the king. And then, of course, getting a lot of attention from everybody, because, of course, they were the premier duke and duchess. They were the Harry and Meghan of the time, you see.
Right. And what was their relationship like? Because in your book, you show perhaps, you know, a companionship, but you have her not particularly madly in love with him.
I struggled with that. consulted a few people, including my wife. How do you deal with the relationship between an older man and a 14-year-old girl without drifting into murky waters? And of course, she thought of him like a father figure. Don't forget, she'd lost her father, so she was in need of a father figure, and he fitted the bill perfectly. He was an old man, not by modern standards, but by Tudor standards. When I was at Grimsthorpe Castle, their portraits hang on the wall in the corridor, quite close to the room where Catherine spent her last days. And on the left-hand side, you've got Charles Brandon, really looking like the elderly Henry VIII, with a very corpulent, with a grey beard. You've probably seen the portrait.
Yeah.
And then to the left of him is the older Catherine Willoughby, but of course she's not that much older. She's only in her 30s. And she looks a young, attractive woman. And I believe she quite enjoyed being Duchess of Suffolk. She liked that world. She got on well with Charles's other daughters, because they were the same age, of course. And it was a breath of fresh air after having been closeted away with her mother, with only servants for company. And although she was 14, she grew up fast, because she started attending Hugh Latimer's sermons at Hampton Court. You've been in the chapel at Hampton Court with the fantastic ceiling. It was in that very chapel, you see, so I can really picture the scene where this, I won't say impressionable young girl, but she had a very inquiring mind and was very questioning about the status quo. So to be legitimately exposed to somebody like Hugh Latimer, who Henry VIII was quite happy for Hugh to be quite controversial, because he enjoyed the way it upset the Spanish ambassadors and people like that, because Henry was quite mischievous as well, of course, in lots of ways. And but Catherine was probably taking notes and thinking, hang on a minute, this is all starting to make sense to me, whereas the Catholicism, her mother, which was, of course, the harsh Catholic, Spanish Catholic.
That's the Spanish Inquisition kind of Catholic.
Right. Yes, that's exactly right. I mean, I don't want to upset any Catholics, because I'm trying to say, if you think of it as a continuum, this was right over to one side, the Spanish Inquisition side of Catholicism. And I think Catherine might have started a bit more over to the other side and then really signed up to the idea of the need for reform. And it wasn't called Protestantism in those days, by the way. Of course, it was just the reformed religion, and they started calling it the true faith. Which is a bit provocative for people like Stephen Gardiner, wasn't it? And of course, you have people like Archbishop Cranmer, hugely influential characters, that said, yeah, we agree. We agree that it's, you know, we've got the Church of England. It's time to make our mark and think about the everyday person turning up at church who sits there blankly and incomprehendingly listening to the music, but not understanding the words. I tried not to make my book too religious, mind you, because that could have been a bit too much the other way, because religion was only one part of the rather complex jigsaw of Catherine's life. And she, you know, she was wanting, really, I suppose, the whole time, some proper love and affection, because her mother was old school love and affection, I suppose. I tried to hint at that. Her father was gone. Charles Brandon was a bit of a, how can I put it? I don't think he might have treated Catherine as much of a wife in terms of his love and affection, because at the end of the day, he married her for her fortune. And he didn't waste any time in taking control of her 30 manors in Lincolnshire and becoming really the elder statesman of the North. So he became the greatest landowner in Lincolnshire and promptly took the money from the dissolution of the monasteries and rebuilt Grimsthorpe. So the Tudor rooms at Grimsthorpe, a lot of those have actually got stone from the nearby Catholic monasteries, and Charles Brandon is the person responsible for it.
So her life during the, after Anne Boleyn and after she's married and she has children with Charles Brandon, she has her sons. And what's life like for her then with Anne of Cleves and the later part?
Yeah, that was, I think she didn't know it at the time, but it was the cleverest move that Catherine made, because what happened was that Henry needed somebody to go and welcome Anne of Cleves. And so he said to Charles Brandon, you can represent me there. Go to Deal Castle in Kent and welcome this queen. And of course, Catherine accompanied him, not realizing that it would change her life. Because later on, that connection and Cleves became a lifesaver for her. But at the time, she could really she could be a huge help to Anne of Cleves, or Anna of Cleves, as I now call her, because that was her proper name. And Catherine knew all about what it was like to be a stranger at the Tudor court and how best to deal with Henry VIII. She would have been quite intrigued by Anna, because Anna could hardly speak English. She spoke German, and Catherine could speak French and Latin, but not German. So it must have been quite interesting to see them develop a friendship.
And so then her husband dies, and there's the whole everything happening with Catherine Howard, and then he was in Scotland, and then he was in France, and then she gets in your book, she has these riders coming in the middle of the night and saying you have to come to be with your husband because he's very sick. So what did she do then after he died?
She went into mourning and put all of her energies into acting as a advocate for the reformed religion. And the kind of thing she was doing, she had all of the money then. And so she was very busy trying to get an English language copy of the Bible into every church in Lincolnshire, and from there every church in the country. That's a major, major undertaking, and guaranteed to upset a certain sort of part of the society, but also to be acknowledged as a valued thing by the rest. And so that took up a lot of her time, and I think it was about 3 years before she finally actually came public with her love affair with Richard Bertie, who was her master of the horse, and quite a interesting character in his own right, because his role in helping them in exile, he was very brave. He could have taken no risk at all. But he actually went to the Tower. He went to Westminster to see if he could negotiate some kind of deal for the family, and stood the risk of being incarcerated in the Tower for life, or executed, or burnt at the stake, or whatever. And he took that risk. And then he went on his own to prepare the way for them, which he needn't have done. And at first, I couldn't understand why he'd done it. And of course, it made sense. He could travel fast and light and incognito and do some negotiating and fix up somewhere for them to live. And then when the family followed, it would be much, much safer for them than just chancing it on their own. They had to move quite slowly. They had Susan was a baby, their daughter Susan. And so, you know, that's part of gives an insight into his character. And their son Peregrine is also an intriguing character at Grimsthorpe. There's a lot about Peregrine around. So They did marry for love. They were very much in love. And one of the things I did was I visited their tomb at the Willoughby Chapel in Spilsby in Lincolnshire. And they're there side by side, Richard and Catherine, effigies of them. And you get a real sense that that's what they would have wished.
I want to go back to her sons with Charles Brandon, because she had quite a tragedy happen with them.
Yes, I mean, I'm trying to avoid spoilers for people that haven't read the book.
Oh, okay. Right.
No, it's well known that the sweating sickness, it must have been terrifying, because the sweating sickness used to sweep through the country, much the same as, I don't know, what would it be?
Like the flu or something?
The flu does now. Except it could take half the population almost within 24 hours if you got it. There was no cure, and you'd shiver and sweat and die, you know. And yeah. Randomly, people used to survive it, and also
like Anne Boleyn survived it.
Yes, that's right. That's a good example. And perfectly fit and well, healthy people like Catherine's sons. They were at university, and to be safe, she moved them right away to an isolated Bishop's Palace at Buckton, which, by the way, is by the connection is that that's, of course, where Catherine of Aragon spent her last days. That's how Catherine knew about it. So she thought, well, I can relax a bit now, because somewhere like Cambridge, the sweating sickness with all the close together houses, narrow streets and everything like that. They didn't know how it was spread, by the way. They still don't really understand it. So can you imagine what it must have been like to hear that one of her sons had the sweating sickness? Because it was like the toss of a coin. There was a 50-50 chance of life or death.
Yeah.
And so for them to both die within hours of each other must have been the end of the world for her, really, because
I can't imagine how you go on from that. I don't know.
Well, I did wonder whether to just have a whole blank chapter where nothing happens.
Yeah.
Because she was just completely, utterly devastated. And of course, this is where Richard Bertie, who was he wasn't really her servant, because master of the horse isn't really the same as a servant. You know, it's a member of the household. So Charles Brandon was Henry VIII's master of the horse, for example. That didn't make Charles Brandon Henry's servant. It made him a valued sort of right-hand man kind of thing.
And Robert Dudley was Elizabeth I's master.
Yes. Oh, that's another good one. And so it's a very good role to have. But what I found out was that Charles Brandon had started a breeding stud at Grimsthorpe. And this is where Richard Bertie had been recruited as an expert horseman. And he did a very good job of developing that breeding stud into something which was renowned, at least throughout Lincolnshire. But you have to remember how important horses were at the time. They were the everyday transport, but they were also the luxury transport of the time. So to be managing the very best, selecting the very best horses and breeding them and then being able to sell them on was a very astute way of running a business. And that was his role. So he would have been quite a comfort, I think, to Catherine when she was possibly her lowest ebb. And what she didn't do was go public with that straight away like Charles Brandon did. She waited 3 years rather than 3 months. And I think that's to her credit, because I think a year would have been enough. But I think it also gives an insight into how utterly devastated she must have been by the experience.
I don't know how anybody recovers from that and then goes on and lives, but you do what you do.
I think her faith helped her through it. So,
yeah.
You know, that if you've got a very devout faith, then that's going to be something that you can use to help survive. as long as you don't start questioning, you know, how God could do that to you, sort of thing. And then, of course, there's a kind of parallel thing here, which is Catherine Parr. You mentioned Catherine Parr. As far as I can tell, that was one of the great friendships, because Catherine Willoughby actually financed Catherine Parr's the publication of Lamentation. And if you look at the title page of Lamentation of a Sinner, then not only is Catherine Willoughby mentioned on the acknowledgements, but also a chap called William Cecil, who you'll know of. He's cropping up in my new book now, William Cecil, as a 50-year-old man. But he was a handsome young guy at the time. Unluckily for Catherine Willoughby, he was happily married. But it would have been a good match, I think, William Cecil and Catherine Willoughby, because they shared a lot of interests, but they also had a lot of similar qualities. And of course, they both had privileged access, firstly to Henry VIII, then to Edward, and then, ironically, Catherine knew, not only did she know all of Henry VIII's six wives, she knew all of his children. And she'd actually played cards with Mary Tudor and knew her well. There's all these fascinating, you know, at school you get given a very black and white picture of it all. It's all very straightforward. Mary Tudor, Bloody Mary, murdered all the, you know, and it's much more complicated than that.
I wanted to ask you, without giving away too many spoilers, when Catherine Parr died, Catherine Willoughby was involved with being named the...
She wasn't too pleased about that, because the last thing she needed at the time was a baby to look after, and especially a Seymour, which you could say was a Seymour, and she didn't have any choice, basically. So they all turned up at Grimsthorpe, not just a baby, but a complete entourage of people, because the child came with its wet nurses and governesses and servants and the whole lot. Mm-hmm. And, it was just a fait accompli, basically. There was no doing anything about it. And just to make matters worse, Catherine was a bit miffed that the money for the salaries of all of these people, and I shouldn't think the running costs of a baby are huge, but it was the size of the entourage which raised an eyebrow, and Catherine was expected to pay them all and had to campaign quite doggedly to get the crown to fulfill its obligations.
Right.
So...
Then I want to also just kind of jump forward. I want to talk about one more phase of her life and then just ask you briefly about how you researched and what it was like writing from a woman's perspective and all that. But I do want to talk about her period in exile, because that was quite important for her. So briefly, what can you tell me about?
Well, she, in the end, all she had was the clothes on her back and what such gemstones and jewelry that she could basically sew into the hems of her skirts. That's how bad it was. So they didn't even end up carrying luggage at one point, because they were on the run, you know. Mm-hmm. And they had little Susan, a bawling baby, and in fact it was hugely dangerous for Susan, because they had to worry about what they were going to do for food. They were having to walk. The weather conditions were atrocious, so there was snow and ice to cope with. And they would knock on somebody's door, not knowing if they were going to be Protestant or Catholic sympathizers. And the whole time, which I think is a bit rotten, and I think if I was mayor, I would have said, best of luck to you. You've decided to go to exile, so I'll leave it at that. She didn't. Whether it was Mary Tudor herself or whether it was her advisors, but people were sent to search for Catherine Willoughby, to try and arrest her and bring her back to be tried as a heretic, which that means that they could never completely relax because there could be a knock at the door. It does remind me of, I shan't say Nazi Germany, but you know, the sort of thing where you never know. Mm-hmm. It was spent. There's another parallel. When Jasper Tudor was in hiding in Tenby, which is close to where I live, Tenby was a Yorkist town. And so he never knew which of his good friends would turn him in, because their Yorkist sympathies were greater than their friendship, you know. Right. And it was a bit like that with Catherine Willoughby. And there's all sorts of I mentioned about the connection with Anna of Cleves meant that they could take sanctuary in Cleves. But at one time, Henry VIII had a brilliant idea of marrying Charles Brandon's widow after the King of Poland. And the King of Poland was up for that. He thought it was a good alliance between England and Poland. But it never happened because, of course, Catherine wasn't like Mary Tudor, that she just had to do whatever Henry VIII said. She was her own woman, and I think a very modern woman, in considering that it was in Tudor times. But when she was in exile, the King of Poland was very happy to help them then. Mm-hmm. So that little episode in her earlier life turned out to be perhaps even a lifesaver in her later life, because with the a safe conduct pass from the King of Poland, then they were almost treated like royalty. And, Richard Bertie got given a top job as a senior administrator in the region, which was extremely well paid and came with a nice house and everything. And that would have been the happily ever after. And then, of course, Mary Tudor died suddenly. Yeah. And the message comes through. They've only just settled down to their whole new life, you know, learning the language of the district and everything. And then they hear Mary Tudor's died, so it's safe to go back. That must have been, you know, I think Catherine Willoughby's life was a series of shocks and surprises, really, because when she got that news, they couldn't really stay where they were. They had to go back because she wanted to make sure then that Elizabeth I was not wavering too much in terms of the new religion and the reforms, and didn't just take the easy route and go back to Catholicism. And of course, as we know, that was a very complex, Elizabeth's religion in the end was whatever suited her at the time, I think.
Yeah.
So after all that, Catherine went back to Grimsthorpe, and
she would have wanted to make sure her lands were safe and everything, I guess.
Yes. Yeah, well, it was all kept well for her. So when she went back, she had a beautiful, Grimsthorpe is in a lovely part of the country. It's a magnificent place with wonderful gardens. And it's a shame in a way, because the landscape has been altered dramatically by a chap called Capability Brown, who put a great big lake in it.
What a great name.
Yeah, but we actually walked through the Tudor gardens, which Catherine Willoughby would have known and loved. And you really do get a sense that the years just vanish, and you can get a sense that she could just be round the corner, perhaps reading her prayer book or something, you know, looking at the view. And it's on a bit of one of the few raised bits of ground in Lincolnshire. Lincolnshire is very flat and reclaimed from the sea, a lot of it. But Grimsthorpe is on a rise. So you've got these magnificent views into the far distance, which are quite inspiring. And it was easy to see why Catherine would choose to return to what was actually her father's house, because her father was given Grimsthorpe by Henry VIII as a wedding present when he married Maria de Salinas. And so her father and mother's spirit imbued the place. And of course, Catherine could use it then as a base to carry on her work to promote Protestantism.
It's such a wonderful story, her life. Like you say, she is quite modern in so many ways. What was it like for you writing from her perspective? And, you know, what did you do to kind of get in character to write her story?
Yeah, people ask me that because they say, how can you possibly... I tell you what, I'll confess that I always struggle with childbirth scenes because although I've had two children and was present, I've got a very different perspective on it. So my wife reads those bits and helps to tone them down or to make them a bit more authentic. But of course, this is the third time that I've written a whole book from the point of view of a woman, because I started with a fascinating woman called Eleanor Cobham. I don't know if you know about
her. Yes,
she was tried for witchcraft and imprisoned for life. So I had to try and get myself into her head. So I went to Beaumaris Castle and sat in the cell that she was actually in. And it's not so difficult as you might think at the end of the day, because there's quite a lot of information around about the lives of Tudor women, some excellent books. And I then obviously wrote about Mary Tudor, Queen of France. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that gave me a bit of practice. And I think I'd like to think that by the time I got to writing Catherine's story, I was much better at seeing the world through her eyes than if I'd not had the practice of writing the previous two books about women. I'm now writing about a rather fascinating chap called Francis Drake. And I'm finding out that virtually everything I thought I knew about Francis Drake was wrong, which I shouldn't be surprised about. But he's a really intriguing character. But I can't wait to get on to writing about Francis's wife, Mary Newman. Very little is known about Mary, but I'm glad I've got her in this story, because he spends a lot of time away at sea. But I can also try and look at how Mary Newman views him. So I've got into this sort of vibe now, and I can quite enjoy writing that.
So we've talked for a long time here, and I thank you for your generosity in sharing your knowledge and in being willing to do this, especially after all our tech issues. So
to say about Catherine Willoughby, I do recommend to anybody that's in the UK to visit the Willoughby Chapel in Spilsby, because it's such, you feel such an instant connection with Richard Bertie and Catherine Willoughby. You know, you can almost sense their presence. It's a bit like when you go to Westminster Abbey and see Henry and Elizabeth of York side by side, or Margaret Beaufort. You feel a connection with them, which you really can't get from watching something on the television or reading it in a book. They're there.
So your book is on Amazon, and people can buy it there.
I'm pleased to say that the actress Ruth Redmond, she's a well-known UK actress that did the audiobook for Mary Tudor. She did a wonderful job. I don't know if you've heard her.
I did,
But she's agreed to narrate Catherine. She's obviously a very busy lady, because it's not going to be available until the new year. But because she's got the previous experience of narrating Brandon's wife, Mary Tudor, she's got a lot more depth and insight into Catherine's story, because she understands about the life at Westhorpe and everything. So I'm really looking forward to hearing that. That'll be out in the spring, probably.
Thank you so much, Tony Riches, for being here and for sharing and for continuing to tell these stories. You tell really wonderful stories, and it's a privilege to speak with you, and it's a privilege to read your books, and I just really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for inviting me, and I really appreciate that. And I look forward to speaking to you again, perhaps one day, about Francis Drake.
Blown on the a scent for Mary sweating. Blow, northern wind, blow, blow, blow. Ich hörte Burdin Bauerbrick, at Sulis Emlich.